Cheryl Nolting.
Hi, Cheryl. It's Jill.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing wonderful, thank you.
Gina Irving.
Hey, Jill. It's Mary Jo Caruso.
Hi, Mary Jo. Hi, Gina. Welcome.
Hi, it's Greg Link at AOA.
Hi, Greg.
Hi.
You're on the right call.
Okay, good.
Hi, Jill.
Hi, everybody.
This is Phyllis Stevenson.
Hey, Phyllis.
Hey, Jill.
Did Kelly say she was on?
Yep, I'm on.
Okay, great.
Cheryl Danil.
Hello, welcome.
Hello.
This is Alicia Blader.
Hi, Alicia. Everybody's just checking in quickly.
Hi, Jennifer Rosenbaum from the New York State Office for the Aging.
Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
I hope that you'll all bear with us today. We're going to try this open-ended.
Hillary Hauptmann.
Hi, Hillary.
Hi.
And hope that it doesn't.
Well, there's no visual to this on the computer, correct?
Right. Right.
Okay.
Trying to cut down on the technological problems, and really focus more on discussion than presentation. So.
Maggie Edgar.
I'm all about it. I just didn't know if I was supposed to be looking at something.
No. There's nothing to look at.
Sunny Udell, Salt Lake City, Utah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Corinda Crosdell, Monroe County's Office for the Aging, Rochester, New York.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Maggie Edgar's here.
Hi, Maggie.
Hi.
Hi, this is Linda Nowell.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Eleanor Kurtz, Oklahoma.
Welcome.
David Best.
Hey, David.
Hi.
Sorry, I missed
David.
Your RSVP somehow.
That's all right.
We'll give it 2 more minutes, and then we'll get started, because we are recording this call, so thank you for agreeing to that, so that we can make this available to more people. We did limit the call to about 26 participants so that it wouldn't get too unruly when it got to question and answer time. So I appreciate that. Why don't we go ahead and get started, just in the interest of time. I did mention the call is being recorded, so if you, for some reason, have to leave early, or you'll be able to listen to the whole call in its entirety in the next couple of days. Just give us a day or two to get it up onto the ARCH website, and I will be sending you all the link on how to link up to that. I also would ask you, if it's possible, to mute your phones while the presenters are making their very quick introductory remarks, and then as you have a question, you can unmute and just chime in, and we'll try to get to each of your questions individually. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Jill Kagan, Program Director of the ARCH National Respite Network and Resource Center. And as you heard, my colleague Maggie Edgar, who's based in Seattle, she is the ARCH Senior Consultant, and she's also on the call today. Greg Link from AOA was kind enough to join us also, so thank you, Greg.
Oh, you're welcome.
In a few minutes, I'll introduce our 4 State Respite Coalition representatives who are going to be answering your questions and facilitating your discussion today. But since we're supposed to have at least 25, 26 folks on the call today, I'm going to dispense with all the introductions, and most of you got to announce your names when you entered the call anyway, so that was helpful. Later on, if you'd like to know who was on the call, I can send that list around to everyone. Before I introduce our facilitators, I want to give you a little bit of background on State Respite Coalitions, very short, and I hope you had a chance to take a look at some of our materials that we have up on the web around State Respite Coalitions also. First, I get this question a lot, are there some standards or Is there something that a state coalition is supposed to look like? And really the answer to that is no. There is nothing in the lifespan respite law or in any of AOA's program announcement that sets out exactly how a state respite coalition should function or how it should be structured or who the members should be. ARCH doesn't have any standards or requirements for ARCH affiliation. In fact, most of our coalitions, especially our most active ones, have been around for a long time, preceding the concept even of lifespan respite. Some of them have been around for more than 10 years. The Respite Care Association of Wisconsin, in fact, was established in the mid-1980s, well before the concept of lifespan respite even came to be. In fact, it really was the work of our existing state respite coalitions that conceived of lifespan respite and moved it to the national stage. Most of the state coalitions started out with a small $500 grant from ARCH way back in the early 1990s to hold state respite awareness days, and they really just grew and took off from there. Most of our coalitions today, though, perform, and this is common to most of them, perform some level of advocacy and oversight at the state and federal levels. But then in their own states, they engage in activities around networking, public awareness, public education, and information referral within their own state. A few coalitions did go well beyond that and move toward providing respite services and respite registries, even dispersing respite vouchers, doing provider training and recruitment. But really, in the lifespan respite law, congressional intent was really for the coalition to be outside of state government, to collaborate with the lead agency, to be able to provide the state lifespan respite program with the additional guidance, the expertise, and even some services if the coalition was that developed across all ages and conditions. So we're really very lucky today that we have with us representatives from four of our most successful and sustainable coalitions.
Hi, it's Amy Nazir.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. Hi, Jill.
Hi. We're just getting started.
Hi, the Illinois Respite Coalition is also on.
Okay, welcome. And would you mind muting your phones because we're about to get into the quick presentations. And
sure.
Then when we have questions, we'll unmute again.
All right.
Our four presenters are Phyllis Stevenson with the North Carolina Respite Care Coalition, Mary Jo Alamina Caruso with the Pennsylvania Respite Coalition, Kelly Tipler, who's on the board of the Tennessee Respite Coalition, and Gina Irve with the Kansas Lifespan Respite Coalition. And Phyllis, I'm going to turn it over to you to get started.
Well, good afternoon, Jill, and everybody on the call. I think somebody is still not muted because there's a lot of feedback. If everybody would mute.
If you have not muted your phone, please do so. Or if you're on a cell phone and have the possibility of being on a landline, that would also help. Or if you're on a speakerphone, that can make the echo prevalent.
Okay. So that's better, I think.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. Well, North Carolina's Respite Care Coalition began in 96, and it was a springboard from the attendance of an ARCH national conference. And a group of people who attended the conference came back and said, we need to start a coalition. And they began networking, reaching out to caregivers, providers, and growing a coalition. It was definitely a grassroots effort supported by ARCH and Jill. In 2003, our group had the invitation to be housed at UCP, which is now Easterfield UCP of North Carolina and Virginia. And that offered us some stability and some financial support. Currently, our coalition probably has about 250 active individuals statewide. We have an established mission and vision. Our uniting mission is to support and promote statewide quality intergenerational respite care. We currently have three regions, and we meet in our region every quarter, and we provide programs of the latest in programs in the area, volunteer models, needs, legislative needs, advocacy needs. We try to make sure our programs are of interest so people will attend and stay connected. We've also offered the option of forming chapters, which can meet in local communities and can take the message from the coalition out into the communities without creating more costs. And we are blending that into meetings that are naturally occurring. Last year, our focus was we held a one-day conference that provided information on growing respite models through faith-based organizations and volunteer models. And we also, through part of our federal grant, wrote a volunteer respite manual in conjunction with AOA that will be coming out as a resource. Our focus for this year is we're really looking at cultural diversity and how that impacts and limits the availability to respite care. And so we're looking at defining what are all the different cultures and how to access respite services in the really remote areas of our state. We're looking to grow respite in each of our counties. We're looking at revamping our website to make it easier to use and more of a resource and referral guide. And we continue to focus on advocacy and legislative needs. And during our journey, Jill has been a huge support with coming and doing awareness days and helping us be well-positioned for advocacy and on how to grow and reach out throughout the state. So that's sort of a quick overview. We do have an advisory board, and we do an annual plan as to our goals and our objectives. And we're trying to really work with holding people accountable and maintaining our statewide reach.
Great. Thank you, Phyllis. Mary Jo, we'll hold all questions until the end, if that's okay with everyone.
Great. Thanks, Jill. The Pennsylvania Lifespan Respite Coalition actually started in 1998 based on a forum of caregivers that were brought together by our state special kids network through our Department of Health. And out of that, we developed a coalition. We got a lot of organizational commitment. We looked at some of the issues that needed to be addressed in our state, and we did a lot of that through an ongoing path planning process, which if you're familiar with a logic model, it's very similar, where we really looked at what we wanted our outcomes to be, what our strengths were, what we needed to implement. And we've been meeting since that time. Our initial goal when we first got together was never about grants, or federal funding, because none of that was really even in our purview at that point. We did a lot of legislative awareness events and community education events to assist people to better understand what the respite issues were. We did a lot of kickoffs in our state capital and got a yearly event going. In addition to our state respite coalition, we had regional coalitions that have always fed into what we do as a state. We successfully co-hosted the National Respite Conference in 2002, which gave us a lot of energy to continue on. We took that group, that coalition, and we utilized the membership to look at some innovative ways to help address respite care issues through some state family support respite funds. And then as we grew both regionally and statewide, we really began looking at doing the respite awareness events, bringing Jill in. Jill assisted us greatly to help look at what our goals were, what our barriers were to obtaining adequate respite. And we formed subcommittees that continue to meet. Those subcommittees are everything from community awareness and education, legislative awareness and education, the development of additional resources, innovative approaches to respite care with no wrong door. We do have an established mission, which is inspired by the desire to help strengthen families and community life. The Respite Coalition in Pennsylvania is there to provide support and relief through access to respite care for caregivers of children and adults of all ages with special needs. And a lot of that came from working with one of our local universities, Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, who really tried to partner with us to see that getting people to understand respite care, getting them to engage in the coalition, getting them to
strengthen the awareness of respite needs was about a public and community health issue. And if we were ever going to generate any funding streams or support funding streams, if we were ever going to host activities to maximize awareness and revenue, we really needed a more diverse and stronger and active respite coalition across the state. And we needed to be able to communicate our vision of success to attract support for our mission. So the University of Pittsburgh was very supportive and very helpful in helping us do that and getting our mission and vision out there. We have over 180 members. Our goal was to have one member in every county of our coalition. So if not you, then who? If you weren't aware of a respite resource, who could you call in that county to help connect families? It has really helped us with our focus. And in addition to that, we are not housed anywhere. We really are a volunteer group. We have worked collaboratively with our state agency in accessing one of the Lifespan Respite grants. They have seen us as a true partner in the process. The benefit for our Respite Coalition in that partnership is we were able to come and share the last 14 years of knowledge that we had, and we thought that knowledge was taken and heard and put into the grant. We truly are a partner in the work, and the state has implemented as a part of the next step of their advisory council, an advisory council of which the Lifespan Respite Coalition maintains a co-chair leadership.
Thank you, Mary Jo. That was great. For any new folks who have come on, have joined us, we have two more presenters to go, so please keep your phones muted, and then we will allow you to unmute as you have your questions put forward. So hang in there, and we have next Kelly Tipler from Tennessee.
Hello. We started as a grassroots advocacy group. Truthfully, it was just a few people within the Department of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities in the state that really saw the need for families that were that had children with mental health diagnoses to get some respite care. And those few people got together and wrote a grant to the Maternal and Child Health for a coalition building grant. And with those funds, they hired a coordinator to start the coalition building process. And once they received the grant, they expanded the scope to not only serve families that had children, but also to go across the lifespan. And through that, that was kind of the first few years, was really just getting to the point of hiring a coordinator and organizing and writing this grant. And also during that time, they did some coalition building activities like legislative advocacy, a legislative awareness day, and also wrote another grant to get a information and referral line started. The information and referral line was just for families with children to begin with. So we found some success through grant writing with state partners. And once the maternal and child health grant came through, that's when it really became more independent of the state and other partners, nonprofits, family caregivers, and grant recipients from the state began joining the Respite Coalition. And the coordinator's position at that time was independent contractor, and they would go around the state and talk about respite. And we actually set up 7 regional groups across the state. And those regional groups did a lot of networking in the beginning. They helped us do a needs assessment to find out both from families and from agencies what the respite needs were. And the coordinator compiled that information and data to use in trying to grow the coalition other ways, funding and legislative awareness. So the coalition started with probably 5 or 10 people, grew to about 75 people once we got the first grant, and by the time we ended the, we exhausted the maternal child health, we had about 1,500 members. Once the funding was exhausted, we decided to become a 501c3 nonprofit agency for the simple reason that we had grown so much that we didn't have the volunteer power to maintain it. And we didn't have a strong nonprofit agency that was willing to take it on at that time. We were really focused on keeping it lifespan, and that kind of created a little bit of a problem because most agencies aren't lifespan. So we became a nonprofit, and at that time we basically had two functions, and that was to continue our advocacy work and also to provide vouchers for families. And since then we've grown into four branches of service, and one of them is to continue our regional advocacy work, and the other is to maintain an information helpline, our regular family-directed voucher respite, and then finally our volunteer respite. So we have those four branches of service, and we still continue to have a lot of volunteers to help our regional groups maintain advocacy and awareness. However, it's without that strong coordinator position to really cheerlead all the time, it's hard to keep the group as big and as active as it was once was, strong at 1,500 members. So that's kind of where we're at, this little overview.
Thank you, Kelly. Very helpful. And our last presenter, Gina Hervé, with the Kansas Lifespan Respite Coalition. Gina, thank you.
Hello. The Kansas Lifespan Respite Coalition started back in 1997. We started as an informal group of volunteers. We are not a 501c3 organization, but rather just a group of organizations from across the state. We have approximately 43 members, plus individual family caregivers. We have representation from various state departments, as well as service organizations, advocacy groups. We have a university center on disabilities, family caregivers, and basically we just make sure that there's a representation of all ages and disabilities from across the state. We have two co-chairs that help lead the coalition, and they're from different parts of the state to help bring in representation, along with a steering committee that helps plan and guide the activities. When we first got started back in 1997, that largely came about because I had been attending the national respite conferences and had been staying up to date on the different initiatives to help create a more coordinated system that would ultimately expand respite resources, and that became the mission of our coalition, was basically to promote access to and use of respite for all caregivers through community awareness, advocacy, education, and collaboration by providing a statewide respite care system. From that, we set up some goals for the coalition, which involved educating, connecting existing resources that do provide respite services, locating training options for those interested in building services, exploring and obtaining funding to help support the services, and identifying the gaps in the service system already and developing strategies to address those gaps. To build our membership, I wrote a grant. It was part of the Compassion Capital Fund. And with that grant, we held a Lifespan Summit. That was pretty much the kickoff to get the coalition formed. So with that, we held a summit and advertised it statewide. I think probably what worked for us, we had about 60 organizations from across the state participate. Probably what worked best for us to get that to gel together was the fact that as a part of the grant, I brought in one of our state universities to help with facilitation even though I was pushing the effort, I am a volunteer director of a small nonprofit that provides respite care services, so I didn't have as much credibility built up with all the larger organizations across the state. So by partnering with the local university, we were able to use their influence to help start attracting and gaining that credibility amongst our now partnering organizations. So they helped lead the summit, and with that we brought down Jill to help disseminate information at the national level, as well as brought Senator Byers from Nebraska and Roseanne Percival from down in Oklahoma, because both have great perspectives of what are going on in other states. So we shared perspectives of what was going on, and from that went forward and started meeting. We meet bimonthly. In year two of our development, which would have been in 1998, we once again wrote another Compassion Capital grant, which helped us to conduct a statewide needs assessment survey. And with those survey results, which all of our partners came together to help get it distributed from throughout the state, that then helped us with our legislative work, where we introduced a bill, although it ultimately did not pass, but it was still an effort that helped to educate our legislators on the movement and what we were trying to advance towards. So our second statewide summit helped to really identify the needs and help express that to get our advocacy efforts more rooted with our legislators. And since then, we are carrying on the organization to help support our state, which was awarded one of the federal Lifespan Respite grants to help provide guidance, expertise, build partnerships as we bring organizations together across the state to help connect and streamline. Our goal is to be supportive in that avenue to help make those grant activities and connecting services and enhancing them more fruitful.
Great, Gina. Thank you very, very much. And all of our presenters, I learn something new every time myself from listening to them share their experiences and their activities. So I'm very grateful that they were willing to share with us today. We can now open it up for discussion and questions. I would just ask that when you unmute your phone to ask your question, that you please identify yourself and your state and your organization before asking your question or making a comment, and we'll see if we can try to do this without everyone trying to talk at once. So does anyone have a question?
I do. This is Sunny Udell in Salt Lake City, Utah, with the Utah Coalition for Caregiver Support, and we are a recent recipient of the Lifespan Respite Grant.
Great, Sunny. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. I enjoyed hearing what everybody is doing. It's so poignant to me now that we're, you know, involved in getting our own piece up and running. We've had a coalition for quite some time, since prior to 2005, probably 2002. And I think all along we've been gearing up to do Lifespan. But my question is, and I'm sorry, I don't recall which presenter mentioned it, but what is the ballpark cost of developing your information and referral line, and how did you go about doing that? And if the answer is not appropriate for here, I'd love to get some information on that. Who was it that said they, they were collaborating with state agencies and developed an information and referral line?
We've got one in Tennessee. I'm not sure if I'm the person you're referring to, but we actually started it very inexpensively through a toll-free line that we actually got through. Oh, let me think if I can remember the name of the company. But it's based through our internet, and it's like $70 a month just to have the toll-free line, which was very important to us because we're so spread out and we have lots of different area codes, and we wanted everybody to be able to access it. And basically our staff person, our helpline coordinator, which at first we didn't have funding for. So we just kind of split up the responsibilities between the staff, part-time staff. But now we have a helpline coordinator, and so her salary. And what we do is we just try to gather the information specifically for respite care, and then deliver that information actually to our agencies on aging and disability, which houses the ADRC. So we carry very specific respite information across the state for the helpline and share that with them because they can't get as detailed as we can get. But our helpline only runs during business hours.
Okay. Thank you.
And this is Mary Jo from Pennsylvania, and I'm not sure if I mentioned ours or not, or if that's what you were referencing as well. Initially, we received some funding from Senator Spector back in 2000 to 2002, and a part of that funding was specifically dedicated to assisting the coalition to give vouchers out to families, but the other portion of it was dedicated to things like the helpline and setting it up and staffing it. When that funding went away, we partnered with a local university, and we shared responsibility for the cost of the line and used student interns to help us take the calls and connect families to resources through our data bank. And now with Pennsylvania being the recipient of the funds, we are actually partnering with a well-known organization within the state that has a wide state reach that is assisting us in not only creating the database, but taking in the calls and helping with that.
Thank you very much.
This is Maureen in New York. Can I ask a follow-up question to that?
Go ahead.
I'm curious to know, do you know approximately in either Pennsylvania or Tennessee, how many calls do you receive a month?
Ours have been increasing in Tennessee since we received the Lifespan funding because we've been promoting it more.
Okay.
When we first started it, it was a double-edged sword because we had the line, but we really were afraid to promote it because we didn't have the staff to back it up. So it was kind of like we told some people about it, and certainly all of our coalition members. So I would say at that time we maybe had 15. Now the last program report I saw was a month and a half ago, or that I remember, I should say, because I know they've given it to me. But we're upwards near 40 a month, so I think our numbers are increasing a lot.
Mm-hmm. And this is Mary Jo. I think when we have funding to give to families in the form of vouchers, we certainly saw the call volume raise, and there
right.
were times when it went over 130 to 200 calls a month. But probably right now, we're at between 40 and 50, but I will also say that we have a Yahoo group site, which we set up after one of our Lifespan Respite summits, and our summits have always included providers and agency leaders and state stakeholders and caregivers, and out of that Yahoo group site, we use that as a network to connect families and anybody who's looking for a respite resource. So we get a lot of hits on our through our website and through our Yahoo group site. And we probably do more that way than we do by telephone today.
Very
okay,
good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that doesn't cost us anything.
Right. Very good.
And free is good.
Free is very good.
Any more questions?
Hi, this is Julie from the Illinois Respite Coalition. I was wondering, I actually have two questions. The first one is, do any of the coalitions that just spoke, do you guys have membership fees?
We don't in Tennessee.
Pennsylvania does not.
Kansas does not.
North Carolina does.
Utah does not.
What are yours, North Carolina?
North Carolina's is for caregivers anywhere from $2 to $5, and many times a coalition member will sponsor that. for an individual or professional, it's $25. For an agency, it's $35 to $40. And every member gets one vote, so the family caregiver has a vote equal to that of an agency.
I didn't get that.
And then the second question was, we heard a couple of you talk about partnering with universities. How did you guys go about doing that? What departments or what channels?
This is Mary Jo. We've done a lot of partnering. And in some cases, we have sought out the partners. In some cases, they've sought us out. And I'll give examples of both. In times when it was sort of a mutual seeking, is we really looked at who some of the partners were and who some of the supporters of the federal lifespan respite legislation were. And that includes the university-affiliated programs, institutes on disabilities. Every state has one. It's housed in a university. And for us in Pennsylvania, that was Temple University, and they were also doing an intergenerational caregiving program and were active in the respite arena in terms of Respite Coalition. So that was a sort of a natural win-win where at the time, Adam Bruner, who worked for Temple University, and I just sort of naturally came together. Other times when we were looking to address specific tasks, we sought out universities. And as an example, the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs is often looking for small, poor, nonprofit groups who are looking to strengthen its mission and vision and presence, and of course that just had our name all over it. And we went and presented to them and said, we need help. And the wonderful thing about it is a lot of times those students are of an international base. And if they weren't understanding what respite was, chances are our typical community member or legislator wasn't understanding what we were asking for either. So they worked with us free of charge to help ensure that our mission, our vision, even our logo and our message were all consistent and clearly understood as a community issue and a public health issue. And then by hosting the respite summits and getting together some of our stakeholders and partners within state agencies and organizations, some of the universities sought us out and said that they wanted to be involved, and either it was through doing a specific project or offering an intern or even perhaps that they were doing a unique volunteer program on their site that was a respite program and they wanted to share that information. And we have found those through community organizing departments, social work departments, masters in public health, rehabilitation science, but even marketing, MBA in marketing programs. So I haven't even felt like it's been going specifically to a healthcare end of a university. It really is looking very broadly at the university and seeing how we can partner with them.
This is Sunny Udell again in Salt Lake. For those of you who did needs assessments, did you find that they were very critical to your process of developing the Lifespan Respite Coalition and getting support?
This is Kelly in Tennessee, and I came in actually after it was done, and I did some of the data compiling. It was very helpful for us when we went to legislators in the beginning, and it was also very helpful when we wrote some of our initial grants. We don't look at the data too much now, but that's because it's about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was very helpful in the beginning. And mm-hmm. It gave I will say this, it gave the regional groups something to do. And sometimes that was really important to keep them
mm-hmm.
cohesive and together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Uh-huh.
On the needs assessment question, this is Jill. I would also say that, you know, if you have a Lifespan Respite grant, that is something your Lifespan Respite program should definitely be engaging in, because you can't begin to identify where the gaps are, the needs are, or the funding streams are until you've engaged in some kind of needs assessment. And you can involve the coalition in helping you do that, but it should be part of your Lifespan Respite program.
Yes. And it definitely is, but there was some balking, if you will, about, you know, spending money and blah, 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 you know. And I don't agree. I think it's very important, but I just wanted some feedback from those who have already done it. So thank you.
Can any of you talk about what the cost of your needs assessment were? I know, Gina, I don't think yours was too costly, was it?
Ours didn't end up being too costly at all because we worked through our partners to help get the survey distributed. Printing was minimal. Postage was even less than that because we did, like through SurveyMonkey, also did an electronic version in addition to the printing.
Mm-hmm.
So that really helped to reduce the postage costs as well. We did a lot of trying to target large group meetings. If any of our partners had meetings of numerous caregivers or other partnering agencies, we tried to get the information pushed out that way. But I will say that our legislators did not want to talk to us without having a needs assessment survey.
Very good.
They didn't want to believe that we needed to have reform until we had the statistical data behind it.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. This is Maureen again. With those of you that have done a needs assessment survey, would you be willing to share that with the rest of us?
Sure.
I believe Kansas is up on our website now, and there are, there's a whole page on needs assessment up on the Lifespan Respite Grantee networking page.
Okay.
But for Kelly's, if Kelly had one she wanted to share, that would be great.
Yeah, I can try to dig it up.
If you don't have it electronically, don't worry about it. I won't make you scan it in or anything.
I mean, Kelly is part. I'm sorry. Jill again.
I was going to say the one thing that's nice about the needs assessment now is we had done them in Pennsylvania over the years, and people were getting a little tired of them in the sense of, well, you keep asking us what our needs are, but then what's the next step? And now with the federal funding, it really gives us the ability to look at those next steps and meet with legislators, and people are actually very enthusiastic about participating in the needs assessment now.
That's good. Money does a lot.
Yes, it does.
Any other questions?
Of course. Jill. and actually, this is to Kelly specifically. Looking at your structure as a 501c3, I'm curious about how it is that you fund the vouchers. Is that part of your fundraising efforts? Because I do see that you do quite a bit of fundraising and things like that. Tell me how that all works together.
We actually write grants, and we work. We've had grants on and off through our department, our aging department here in the state. We've also written to private foundations. We do fund some of our vouchers through our fundraising efforts, but we don't make enormous amounts of money through our fundraising efforts. They are really for administrative costs more than anything. So a lot of our vouchers, the amount that we are able to deliver ebbs and flows with our grant funding. We write grants. We try to write grants often. Not often enough, but we do try, and that's where a lot of it comes from.
Okay, so it doesn't come through the state government or anything like that? It's primarily
some of it does. Some of it does, but it's not from legislation. It's from specific RFPs, programs that the state funds.
Great. Thanks, Kelly.
Sure.
This is Amy Nazaire from Massachusetts. And I just have a question about the actual commission meetings that you all have and kind of how those meetings are structured, how often you meet. We're kind of just starting to revitalize our coalition and finding that that's a challenge, having the meetings be enough of a draw for people.
Food and... food and door prizes, and we also, our early meetings, we did a lot of networking, and we would ask an agency to present their respite program, and so that kind of kept people coming because we kept asking people to present.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just anything that we could do to really bring people together. We ended up, the most attractive thing that I think kept people coming was we gave every region a little pot of funding. And by little, I mean we might have started with $200 or and grown it to $500. And now we have a little bit more, but we gave the group the money to distribute in the form of vouchers and stretch it as much as they could, and they did a great job of that. But it kind of kept the group together and made them feel like they had a little power over something.
Mm-hmm.
Our regional groups or our county groups meet once a month. We meet as a state via the phone, you know, about once a month. And we can only, because Pennsylvania is just so far stretched, and it's, mm-hmm. you know, 7 hours from one end to the other, depending on where you're coming from, we get together once a year. And we do that in September with the recognition of our Lifespan Respite Awareness Week in our state government. But other than that, we do a majority of it over the phone, and then the regional groups all do their own fundraising and have vouchers to give out. So mm-hmm. if people don't get together, then they can't give out the vouchers, and that's their incentive.
Okay.
This is Angela Heath from the D.C. Respite Coalition, and one of my questions is, what do you guys see as the advantages and disadvantages to having an sort of an informal coalition, one that is not a 501c3? I mean, certainly I understand the limitations around grants, but do you see any other advantages and disadvantages?
Phyllis, you've got a great coalition that's not 501c3.
Well, thanks, Kelly. Well, first of all, I want to go back and respond to the question about the meetings, and then I'll talk to you about the 501c3. Our meetings are a little bit different. We do meet quarterly in each region, and we also have chapter meetings that spring off from there that allow people that if there's a group that already has a topic that's meeting, that they can take the message from the coalition and they can incorporate it there, trying to make our material very user-friendly. I think the reason our meetings have still continued to thrive is because we do feed them, we do some fun things like door prizes and that kind of thing, but the information on the agenda is very relative to the work that they're doing, whether it is something that's coming within our state, whether it's a new program idea that we can do in a more cost-effective manner. Last year we did a lot of work on volunteer models. Right now we're going to do some really big work on cultural diversity, which I think will help us with other programs as well. So I think a lot of it is setting an agenda that is of high value to those who want to attend that they can incorporate either in their daily lives or in their programs. And then as far as 501c3 versus not 501c3, in North Carolina, we've had that conversation so many times. We've written our packet, but we have been very gifted in that Easter Sales UCP has allowed the coalition to be under its umbrella of its 501c3 as a program, and they are actually contributing some dollars toward part of the staff time. So at some point in time, maybe when we grow larger, maybe if there is more funding for the coalition to be strong enough to be out on its own, we would go back to moving forward with a separate 501c3. But right now it's more advantageous for the coalition to be housed under this larger nonprofit that is supporting it with computers, some telephone, travel, and probably, you know, 20 to 30 hours a week of part of the staff time. So right now our situation is very unique. I would say, though, that there are some large nonprofits who do a lot of respite work who might be some really natural partners as you are looking at forming your coalitions and your partnership. And so, you know, don't rule those out. I think there are advantages each way. And someday I think we will go for ours, but it would be when we were in a much stronger financial position and the economy was stronger. But right now, the way we are seems to let us grow the message of respite And we've done a really good job in reaching statewide, and we're a very long state. We're a very diverse state, but, you know, with that kind of support, we've been able to reach about all of our counties and build a good partnership with the agent and the grant as well.
Because I think being housed within another 501c3 organization is probably equivalent to being a freestanding 501c3. It's the 501c3 status that really enables you to have access to outside funding sources that you might not otherwise have access to.
It's really been a gift, you know, like with autism increasing and some of the issues that are on the agenda, that some of the larger 501c3s have wealth of information that you can combine with your respite services. You know, there's some really natural partnering there, so I would certainly explore all options as you're figuring out how you move forward. And the other advice I would give you is, you know, sit down and do a strategic plan. I mean, listen to what all of us have to say, but then go back and do a planning process about what is unique in your state, where does it need to go, what are your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, how do you blend those together to build a coalition and take the message of respite throughout your state and build the greatest opportunity. So, you know, each of you will probably look like something very different from what you're hearing, but maybe little pieces of this will show up.
Any more questions? If no one has a question, Jill has one. Could you all talk a little bit more about, I think Gina listed who her members were, but can you talk about who your membership is? Who joins your coalition?
This is Kelly. We've got partners from nonprofits to family caregivers. It's really across the board, but I would say that our heaviest membership is staff from other nonprofit agencies.
When you say other nonprofits, do you mean respite providers
or
disability organizations? Or
it's really across the board because all of them are usually dealing with clients that need respite. We don't have a lot of respite providers in Tennessee, so that's why I say, but we've got the Autism Society, the MS Society, Alzheimer's Association, but we've also got the ARC, which is a respite provider.
Right.
We also have quite a few for-profits, like assisted livings and home care companies that are part of us, too, which can be beneficial sometimes when we need door prizes or sponsorships.
Right. Phyllis, can you talk about your...
Sure. Our membership... We have some caregivers, and I would say we probably right now have 30 to 40 caregivers. And the reason that they are really active are a few reasons. One is their membership cost is very low. They don't have to attend all the meetings, but every other year when we do our conference, we do a special caregiver track where for a portion of the day they go and they can get a massage, they get totally taken care of. There's like a whole track of things just for caregivers that no one else can go to. And having that track at our every other year conference has really built up our caregiver membership in the coalition as a whole. A lot of our other members are people who are either providing respite, or work with other agencies who provide respite, and some of the people from government, you know, from the Division of Aging, a couple of people from social services, so probably some government membership as well, and it is some for-profit and non-profit on the business membership, and we are probably really equally dispersed throughout the state. We have a really strong membership in our mountain area, which is a very hard area to reach, but our respite coalition has been, you know, very strong there, and So I think even if you have geographic challenges, you can still grow a pretty strong membership.
Great, thank you.
We do have government. I forgot about it. Jogged my mind a little bit when Phyllis said that. In Tennessee, we also have our state departments are members.
And I think in Kansas, that has been very helpful. We have a strong representation from numerous state agencies as well, and I think that that is helping all the more to solidify the statewide system, as well as not just having those that are on the forefront providing the services, but also having the different levels, whether we have local government involved as well as our state. And that's proved to be very supportive, and they're actually even looking into possibly providing some funding to support the coalition as well.
Good. In Pennsylvania, I think we're seeing an increase in family caregivers wanting to be a part of the coalition, and I think my experience thus far is it's because there's a really strong interest on behalf of caregivers to be informed, not just in terms of what resources are out there, but what legislation is out there, what funding is coming to the state, how that funding is managed, and they really want to have a strong presence and a voice, and I see them as not just wanting to be informed, but they want to participate and they want to partner and collaborate as much as possible. And they've been amazingly helpful in helping us get the word out, in addition to having the providers and the home care agencies and the statewide, the stakeholders from state agencies. We have a lot of representatives from different sign-on groups, the veterans, the Alzheimer's groups, the head injury people representing the head injury organizations, and then we have representatives on our coalition of all three of what I call the sister agencies, the federal partners, the Institute on Disability Protection and Advocacy, and the Developmental Disabilities Council.
Anyone else have a question? The floor is yours.
I had a question. This is Alicia Blader from North Carolina. I wondered, I think it was Mary Jo that talked about it. One of the things that we're looking to do in North Carolina is obviously increase partnership and look at marketing and various things, and I think there was a comment about pushing to get respite seen as a public health, community health issue. And I agree with that, and it's a big challenge. And I wondered what that state coalition or anyone else has had success in feeling like they're moving the needle toward that.
Well, I think in Pennsylvania, again, it was the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs that was so helpful to us in this, because what they were saying is, you know, we sometimes would get the message out based on what our funding was. So if we got a lot of funding for respite for children, it seemed like the focus was children. If we got respite from, I think it was the Rosalind Carter Foundation at one point, specific to people who lived in these flood zones, then it seemed specific to that. And the feedback we got was it was not, our message was not lifespan enough. It was not embraceable enough. It didn't look like it could be you. It could be your neighbor. It could be you caring for your parents. And they really helped us with that in terms of developing some materials and developing some vision statements that really could be grasped by the greater population. And then on the marketing end of it, they were able to, at one point a few years ago, get a billboard agency to put up billboards around the state that just put our message out with our phone number on it. And that was just tremendously helpful at increasing awareness and helping our call volume and getting interest in what it was that we were doing.
Thank you.
I wonder if any of you could talk about the value of having a paid staff person. I know in Pennsylvania and Kansas there is no paid staff person. Has that hindered you at all?
Well, I think things were certainly easier for us when we did have a paid staff person for a brief period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the, you know, early 2000s, I certainly saw things happening in a much more streamlined way. Now we have to really
as a coalition, go on volunteers to take on certain responsibilities, and people certainly come to the table, but it doesn't have that same reliability of having a paid staff person and that same level of accountability. And if, you know, if we got funding for that, that would be one of the first things that I would do is fill that role.
In Kansas, I would say we don't have a paid staff position mostly because it hasn't been an option for us. On the upside, it has kept things simple in that we haven't had to deal with fundraising nor hiring and policies related to that. But on the other side, we are relying upon volunteers, and that's where it's been important to have two co-chairs as well as a steering committee so that we can divide up the responsibilities so no one person gets burned out.
Thank you. Any last questions? You've got these four wonderful people here with so much information.
Jill?
Yeah?
Hi, it's Christy Fair from Texas.
Yes. Hi, Christy.
Hey there. I don't mean to backtrack, but I decided I've got a question related to the folks who talked about having an info line.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I'm from the Texas Department on Aging and Disabilities, and I have here our Lifespan Respite Grant Coordinator, Cheryl Nolting, with me in the room. And as a state agency, we take a pretty strong, I think, leadership role in the support and development of our coalition and the implementation of our program as a whole. So we're, as a state agency, we're pretty involved. So one thing we have made a decision about is that we're not going to set up an info line or a separate information line or fund it. We're rather, as one of the comments went, going to really try to make our web-based our website and our web-based materials and very versatile and user-friendly for caregivers and professionals alike. But in regard of, you know, related to the idea of people calling in for information about respite or referrals to resources and services, we are going to collaborate heavily with our 211, Texas 211. We've made a lot of progress with them already on ways that we can expand and enhance their own infrastructure and resources so that it can have a rapid and ready response to questions about 211, and I mean about respite, but using the already existing infrastructure of the 211 to do that for us. And I wondered if any other state on the line is really dogging that like we are, and if you've got any experiences with it.
In Tennessee, we our Area Agency on Aging, our ADRC line, is kind of what a lot of people go to more than our 211. Uh-huh. And so we didn't feel like they could provide as detailed information about respite services across the state, especially the little programs that maybe are held in small communities at
right.
communities and things like that. So we want to provide them with that information, but still would like them. It's one of those kind of double-edged swords where we want them to be the point of entry for the state, just to follow the state plan, but at the same time, we want to make sure that families get the extra attention they need if they're in a caregiving situation. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, that's good insight.
Yeah, I just want to chime in here. This is Jill very quickly. That is almost exactly why the language was written into the law about the involvement of the state respite coalition, because we want to make sure that there's that respite expertise there that's outside of state government that will be able to do the little bits and pieces, you know, on the ground that maybe the state can't get to. And there's a beautiful example of a no-wrong-door approach in Tennessee and a great partnership between the coalition, which has, you know, its own unique services that it can provide that will work in collaboration with the state lead to run the program as well. But that's a great description of what the relationship should be between the coalition and the state agency and the state program. There's a difference between the Lifespan Respite Program and the State Respite Coalition.
Right.
Yeah.
And I agree, Jill. That's a great example because in Pennsylvania we ran into two problems over the past 14 years of using the state agency. One was they were not able to direct a family to a certain organization even if they knew that was exactly what met their needs. They were required to give them a list of all available resources in that county, even if they didn't serve the individual with that specific disability or it wasn't the type of the respite the family was looking for. So we would have families calling us very frustrated, saying that they were having to make sometimes 20 to 25 phone calls just to scan through the list, and they really wanted that individualized attention that the Respite Coalition could give them of really listening to what they wanted and directing them. And then that even got a little crazier when our state outsourced some of their call center activities, so it wasn't even somebody within the state who was giving them that information. I think we outsourced it to Colorado. And that made it even more challenging for families to get information. So we felt it was really important, both in our regional coalitions and our state coalition, to have people who could really be more hands-on, with, especially with family caregivers.
And Jill and Mary Jo, this is Mary Beth Famulari, the Pennsylvania as well, the Aging and Disability Resource. And what we're doing in Pennsylvania is really working to merge the ADRCs with respite coalitions and really pull that back into the communities of our ADRCs are a decentralized model, so it's really a network of partner agencies. So how can we work to educate and train and pull together resources for all of those partner agencies in every county and combine that with the work of the Respite Coalition?
See, and I think that's a great example about what the respite funding can do, is pull together those entities to start to look together to say, how can we give out common language? How can we help families navigate? And I think that will be a wonderful outcome, at least in Pennsylvania, of the use of our federal funds.
Hey, I just wanted to chime in here from Minnesota on this question because it seems to be where our early efforts are focusing most on the information and referral and the different ways people get or access services. And our ADRC efforts in Minnesota are predominantly virtual. That is, they're through our series of linkage lines or our information telephone lines for disabilities, seniors, and veterans. And then we have our Minnesota help.info website. And I think similar to Texas, I think our approach in general, and this has been driven largely by stakeholders in the coalition, have been to build on this system rather than mirror it somehow. And I think there are very unique and detailed needs of caregivers in various circumstances, but I think what we've been trying to do in the last several years, not so much through a respite coalition or caregiver coalition, because we're very new at that, but just through our reform and policy efforts in general, are to make sure our customer lines through the senior linkage line and disability linkage line and through the Minnesota Help.info website, that we really make a lateral progression in those phone calls, because so often people who are calling for advice about a disabled family member or friend or a parent or whomever it may be, it's so often a caregiver calling or inquiring. Sometimes it's the person who has a service need themselves. So what we've been doing is a lot of education with our customer service folks, which are in state, fortunately, still, to make sure they're recognizing that there are two customers on the phone, in a sense, that, okay, I'm getting questions about a person's mother, but what is this person calling? What might they need? And I think it's just a paradigm shift, but I think we need to do it instead of duplicating customer service lines, really educating our primary customer service folks on the needs of caregivers. And then making sure, of course, that the resources, the information about informal to formal services to support caregivers are at their fingertips. So it's, you know, so anyway, I guess I would echo that that's been our strategy, or where we seem to be going, is to really beef up and improve our current point of entry.
Yeah, this is Texas again. Thank you, Minnesota. I mean, that's the kind of exactly what we're trying to do. Yeah, I appreciate your comments.
This is Lois from Illinois with the Illinois Respite Coalition. And for everybody on the call, you know, I was wondering if you guys could give us a word of advice. Our experience over the past year is that we have probably unfolded hundreds and hundreds of 800 numbers in Illinois. And we were hesitant in creating another one for respite, but thought maybe we should try to infiltrate all of the 800 numbers that are existing out there to direct people to the Illinois Respite Coalition for respite services. But like Mary Jo said, that's going to be extra calls than a caregiver is going to have to make or a family is going to have to make. I'm going to mute my phone, and you guys, if you could kick this around, we're really we're struggling with this a bit.
I think that regardless of where the number that is called, I think there has to be somebody involved with the coalition giving good, detailed information to wherever that call center is. I don't know. Anybody else?
I think part of the problem, and this is Jill again, is that we're talking about states that already had a very well-established state respite coalition with lots of respite expertise and organization that was available when the grant was written. And then we have states like Texas and Minnesota that did not have a state respite coalition in effect when they wrote their grant. So they're in the process of building their coalitions, I think, and trying to figure out what will be the role of the state respite coalition. It may be that in Minnesota you don't need the State Respite Coalition to be doing the INR piece or to be collecting the information. There might be some other role, some other reason for pulling those outside groups together that will be helpful to your program. It may have nothing to do with your respite registry or your information referral line. But the point is, you're in a different position than these states that already had a coalition that had services and expertise to offer. So you have to think about building your coalition and thinking about what is their role going to be? Why? What are we going to do with this group of experts who have their expertise in respite? And what are they willing to do? What can they do?
I think that this is Amy from Massachusetts again. And Jill, I think you hit on exactly that's where we're coming from, too, that we really don't have a well-established coalition. So I've been struggling as throughout this call around, what is the respite program or grant, you know, the purview of that versus to what extent should we really focus on establishing a stronger coalition right now? Like, which comes first, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Maureen, and I absolutely echo what Amy just said in Massachusetts. You know, there's the detail work that we need to attend to, obviously, but then, you know, at what point, you know, does the rubber hit the road also? How do you balance both?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the most valuable things that we did as we were building our coalition in the early days was to invite people to speak and really start building the database of resources, because that didn't exactly exist in one spot. And I think that was the beginning of us feeding of us establishing our helpline resource, but also being able to feed it to our, you know, one-stop shop or no wrong door line. So I think, you know, if you're in the beginning stages of just building your coalition, that can be an activity that actually brings people together
is gathering all of the resources. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes great sense. Thank you.
Yes.
And I think what in Pennsylvania what we've learned is through our years of experience as a coalition is what our limitations are and what, for example, volunteers can and cannot do, and the benefit of the federal funding, the way I see it from the coalition perspective, is partnering with our Aging Disability Resource Center and really seeing them as an equal co-chair at the table. That has been wonderful for us. And knowing that, yes, we have data about the call volume and the importance of getting that direct connection, but we don't have to be the one necessarily to do it all the time, and that we can, through the advisory council that's been created through our federal grant funding, be able to, again, share the message and partner with other people who can pick up different pieces. And it may seem fragmented in some ways to some of us as we get on this role, but I'm hoping to the consumer, to the caregiver, that it will feel very seamless.
This is Angela with the DC Coalition, and we're unique, I guess, since we are both, state government AAA. We're the recipients of the Lifespan Respite Grant, and we're starting the coalition in DC. But what we are planning to do is we are sort of establishing the coalition, starting with members from D.C. government, both the agencies and also, when I say agencies, I mean the D.C. government agencies, but also the grantees that they fund. We started with them as an inaugural coalition, if you will, and we're at the point now where we're getting ready to expand that broad base around the city, offer different agencies opportunity to join us and to work in this effort. But our charge is to really roll the coalition into another agency so that it won't actually be housed or shepherded by D.C. government. And so we're, I was listening to someone earlier who was saying, like, how do you kind of balance the two? And we were thinking that the role that the ADRC could play with the D.C. coalition is more of an administrative support role, but that the coalition would actually be under another 501c, and maybe their term. Maybe it lives under an agency for 2 or 3 years. I mean, it's something we're going to talk about as a group, and then maybe it goes to another agency for 2 or 3 years.
Some coalitions have done it that way also, share the leadership.
Did that work for you?
This is Jill from, but there are some other coalitions that have done it, and it works until you run out of organizations that are willing to continue to be the leader.
Yeah.
I mean, I think all of you that are building your coalition should think of them as a gift to you. It may seem like you're having to develop your Lifespan Respite program and also working on developing your coalition, but if you can hand the coalition over to the outside groups to build, you're building in some funding sustainability there, too, because they're going to be your undying advocates, whether it's for federal funding or state funding. They're going to continue to be there to support you. And so the broader base of your coalition and the better working relationship you have with them, I think it's a very important part of thinking about sustainability. And think of it more as a gift to you in building partnerships than someone who's going to compete with you or cause you extra work. Especially if you can get, find someone in the community, those of you who are state agencies, trying to build your coalition. Try to find some leaders outside of state government that can help take the lead in building that coalition rather than you doing it yourself. One more thing you have to do as the state agency.
I think, this is Amy from Massachusetts again, I think where we're struggling is, and again, we're really at the beginning stages, but is, like, I see in my mind, I kind of combine the two, and I think, well, the coalition meetings
we can work on the grant. We can get people to work on the grant through the mechanism of the coalition, and I feel like somehow I've got it backwards or something.
This is Phyllis from North Carolina, and Alicia is on the line, and she's from North Carolina, and I'm the coalition. I represent the coalition, and she represents the Agency on Aging, and I'm going to speak for us, but Alicia can tell you if I'm wrong. I really think that we have a really good relationship in working this out and understanding the different roles. You know, the coalition is the grassroots movement to develop the message about respite, to integrate the caregivers, to help take the message about the lifespan need, to do some advocacy. And our partnership with the Division on Aging, we have a great state advisory council. The projects that come under the grant, we sit down each year, we just sit down and went over our what we need to work on for this year that works well for the grant and also is a great fit with the coalition. It lets us have two different voices. It gives us more diversity in addressing respite. And there was a conversation that went on earlier that I wanted to respond to as well, and that is, this is not going to be a one-size-fits-all. And when you're looking at the info and referral line, I really would encourage you to do a strategic analysis for the coalition's role in your state that might fit for you and it might not be. Because like in North Carolina, we have a system of care. A lot of our mental health recipients who need respite would enter through there. DSS has a different referral system. And then the Division of Aging, we're trying to register all of our respite in that system. And so we try to use the systems that are already in existence. But I can understand the challenge in seeing how the two roles are different, but they are different, but they're very complementary, and they can bring more diverse knowledge and expertise to make what you're doing more far-reaching. And Alicia, I don't know if you want to add anything onto that. Maybe Alicia's gone.
This is Sharon in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a very small state compared to others, and this morning was the second group that we brought together from various agencies that have constituents who provide caregiving, but none of the agencies seem to really have a handle on the needs of their constituency for caregiving. So I'm really interested in, and it would be extremely helpful if I could have the needs assessments that have been done from various states for the actual questions, because we're struggling this morning with what questions would we ask for information to use the data. So if there are others other than Kansas, I would like to know that. And I'm sorry to have butt in, but I didn't want you to get off the phone without my asking.
Yeah, actually, there's the Delaware needs assessment, the Alabama needs assessment, and I think a couple of others, Arizona, are up on our website.
Okay, on the ARCH website, then, that's where I would go and get the actual needs assessment, the questions.
Yeah, I think the actual questions and answers are up there. I think Kansas, we just have the questions. We don't have the results.
Oh, thank you.
But if you need those links, I'm happy to send those to you so you can get to it directly.
I've had a hard time locating them. This is Sunny. I've just had a hard time finding them. I know they're there, but I can't get to them.
Okay. I'll send you the link so you can find it directly.
This is Marcia Albert in Nebraska. And our Lifespan Respite Coalition and our network are sort of different than the others. Our coalition does basically our advocacy activities and works with our state legislature and does different things like that, has a senator's luncheon every year for our senators here in the state. Our network does the activity of public awareness, the 866 respite number that's answered based on what an individual's telephone number is. It directs them to one of our 6 respite coordinators in the state.
When you say network, Marsh, just to clarify, that is your Lifespan Respite Program.
Right. That is our Lifespan Respite Program that our state legislature passed in 1998, and we implemented in 1999, our program. And we have, it's two parts. We have both the network, which is the public awareness and marketing activities, the recruitment of respite providers and things like that. And then we have the subsidy where we're able to provide funding for families to receive respite.
Now just to give some other examples, this is Jill again. While your coalition is building in your state, developing its own unique services and purposes and meeting your particular needs. There are, again, those states where the coalitions were already very active, like in Alabama, like in Connecticut, like in Tennessee, where they were already almost functioning like a Lifespan Respite Program before the state got the funding. So in those states, of course, they're going to rely more on their coalitions to actually help deliver some of the services, so they don't have to rebuild, you know, those networks and that information base again. But that doesn't mean that's what you have to do with your coalition in your state.
Right. And that's our coalition was very active in getting our state legislation passed.
Right. And so that's the role that they kept.
Right.
Instead of getting more, you know, to actually providing some of the services, they decided they were just going to be an advocacy coalition, that's where their services were most beneficial.
Right.
Alabama, and Connecticut, other states where their expertise really lies in information referral and being the point of entry, you know, why not take advantage of what those coalitions are already doing and have the years of expertise in doing? Again,
yeah.
It doesn't mean you have to do it that way in your state.
Right. And we do have, you know, monthly meetings with our coalition. We're very very active together between our network and our coalition, and we're working with our ADRC in developing a joint computer program for, we're going to move our information from our respite program that we have now into the ADRC computer program.
We're getting to the almost 90 minutes on this call. If anyone has any last-minute questions, I urge you to ask them now. We'll take one or two more.
Hey, Jill, this is Maggie. I just wanted to comment. I don't know if you mentioned earlier that we do have fact sheets on state respite coalitions on the website.
Yes, I sent that around prior to the call and asked people to please review them. It'll give you, I'm glad you mentioned it again, though, Maggie, to remind people that if you want to learn about all the various configurations and activities of all the different respite coalitions, those fact sheets are very helpful. They also tell you what materials people have to share, et cetera. Any other questions? Well, before we close, I did want to let people know that we have already scheduled another topical conference call like this for March the 10th. It's going to be related to a lot of the questions that were asked today on respite registries, but we're going to be focusing on how can we improve the Arch National Respite Registry so that it might be a model for what you're doing at the state level, or something perhaps that you can plug into rather than having to develop your own web-based strategy. And for those of you who are at the Lifespan Respite Grantee meeting, you remember that we had some folks from care.com who presented at that time, and we've continued to work with them to see what it is they can do to help improve our national respite registry. And they're going to be presenting on that March 10th call their initial proposal for that, and they very much want to get state feedback for that proposal and to talk to you about what is it that you would need from a national database like that, how might you be able to plug into it? And what kinds of guidance and information do you have that would help make this the most useful tool? So I hope you'll join us. It'll be March 10th at 3 p.m., and I'll be sending something around about that, but I wanted you to be able to save the date.
Hey, Jill, this is Maureen. I've got a quick question regarding that, if that's okay. The proposal that's going to be presented, this would be for a national respite registry, correct?
Yes, but if there's...
Okay.
They really don't think it's beneficial to go state by state. So if we can make a national
right.
respite registry that you could tailor, perhaps, for your own state use, I mean, that's a possibility. I'm sorry.
Right.
You can ask your questions.
Oh, no, because my question was going to be, I mean, I was at the meeting. Would this be a membership thing, or is it going to be something that, you know, through our state funding and the federal funding, that you just become members and you have access?
Yeah, it's through the grant, so there
Got it.
At this point, no charge for anything. Hopefully
Got
not
it.
At any
Thank
point.
You. Yeah, thanks.
Anyone else have a question about that or anything else on the call today? Then I want to thank our presenters very much. Excellent job, Coalitions, Phyllis, Mary Jo, Kelly, Gina. Thank you very, very much. I learned a lot more today than I've ever known myself, so thank you very, very much. And if you think of questions after you get off this call and you'd like to talk directly with any of our presenters or myself or Maggie, please feel free just to drop us a line or give us a call. We're here to answer those questions. So thank you very much, and we'll talk to you on March the 10th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you from Linda Porter.
Thank you.